Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Jim, gang violence is ever-present, from the streets of Chicago and Los Angeles to criminal indictments issued just this month in Savannah, Georgia. There's also a case of white supremacists operating in Grand Prairie, Texas. So many forms of violence linked to gangs.
Yeah, there's one estimate that 1.4 million people in this country are involved in some sort of gang.
So certainly this isn't going away. Fighting gang violence, Jonathan Green.
The gang that brings the most violence is the one that makes the most money, is the one that wins. Sex, money, murder had a reputation for killing anyone who stood in their way. And soon their reputation became so well known, but they didn't have to murder anyone. People would just sort of step back and say, well, we don't want any part of that.
Our show is about fixes.
Yeah, how to make the world a better place.
How do we fix it?
How do we fix it?
So let's talk about sex, money, murder.
Yes. So some of our favorite topics. Actually, that was the name of a notorious gang that operated and to some degree still operates in New York City. But we're going to focus on its heyday about 20 years ago.
In the late 80s, early 90s, when the crack epidemic was linked to a spike in murders and killings. And anybody who lived in this city, including us, certainly felt the implications of this, because serious crime was just so much bigger than it is now.
It's literally like night and day. Our guest is Jonathan Green. He's the author of the new book, Sex, Money, Murder, A Story of Crack, Blood, and Betrayal.
Thank you for having me here.
Your book paints a vivid and even devastating picture of one New York City borough, the Bronx, where the gang Sex, Money, Murder actually operated. Tell us about its leader, a guy called Pistol Pete.
Pistol Pete was an extremely charismatic guy. He was a legend in the Bronx at that time. He was friends with celebrities, and he was sort of unusual amongst Bronx gangs at that time because he was willing to carry out a lot of the murders himself. Now, normally in these gangs, this is the type of work that gets delegated to junior members in the gang.
At his height, how old was he?
He was a young guy. I mean, I think early 20s, I think, when he was really at his peak.
And just the way that singers celebrated the gunfighters of the 19th century and the outlaws, he turned up in a lot of music, a lot of songs.
Yes, he has. Nas has rapped about him. And Pete really had his own two rappers from Soundview, Lord
and Soundview, Tariq. Just for people who aren't from this area, is a neighborhood in the South Bronx that it was really notorious for some projects that were riddled with crime.
Yes, like that's where Pete came from, and it was an extremely tough neighborhood. You know, very tough place to grow up, and even worse in the middle of the crack epidemic.
Give us a sense of how Sex, Money, Murder operated.
Well, they started out as a corner clique, and then they became larger, and they got more recruits.
What do you mean by a corner clique?
Well, just sort of a few guys in the neighborhood who would control a corner to sling crack, and then they got larger. In 1992, they called themselves Sex, Money, Murder. And at that time, they were the first crews in the Bronx to start going out of town. Sort of upstate New York in Massachusetts, where there's weak law enforcement. They're not going to run into any problems with other gangs there. So it's a great place to start selling crack because you have no opposition.
How profitable was crack?
Oh, massively profitable. I mean, huge amounts of money. So it's not worth as much in the Bronx, but the more you go up to places like Springfield, Kingston, New York, Buffalo, where sex, money, murder are all active, then the price of the drugs can be worth 2-3 times as much.
Talk about the crack epidemic, because it really was rampant.
Yeah, I mean, it was very different to heroin, where it's a long, slow high. Somebody described it as like being in a high-speed elevator, and you hit the top, and then you come down really fast, and the next time you take another hit, you need more to get up to that same floor, like where you were at first. And you don't want the feeling to ever ebb or fade.
And because it was broken down into small bags of, you know, $5 or $10, as opposed to, you know, $100 or something like that for a gram of powder cocaine that more upscale people were taking, it was something that people could manage on the street. They could get that $5 bag, but of course then they'd want to be back 2 hours later for another one.
Yes, and I think crack also brought a sort of democratization of the drug trade. Heroin's very expensive. A kilo of heroin back then could be like $180,000. A sort of kilo of cocaine at that time is like $18,000. So any street crew, like with enough guys, could actually have enough cash, could buy one, and then you're in the drug game.
Now, the way you got involved in this story was quite a few years later. How did your connection with these particular gangsters begin?
Well, I had a friend who's a federal investigator, and he sort of called me up one day and he said, look, I got these two guys who are in this crew. It's not bullshit stuff. If you want to come down and meet them, do. So,
and this was Suge and Pipe.
Well, it was just Suge at first. So I met Suge in the U.S. Attorney's office, and this is a really tough street guy, and he talks a million miles a minute, so it's like a machine gun. And he did it, and there's a lot of slang, and at first we really didn't understand each other. You know, he was completely thrown off. I had an English accent, and I didn't understand a lot of the lingo. You know, gas is a gun, burner is a gun. They had phrases like rock him to sleep, which means to murder a guy. So this story tumbled out, and, you know, I did my best at understanding it, but I...
And this was years after the events in question,
yes.
Right? This was something like 2012?
Yeah, but sex, money, murder is still very active.
How did sex, money, murder corner the drug trade in its neighborhood?
Well, Suge told me, here's how it works. The gang that brings the most violence is the one that wins. The gang that brings the most violence is the one that makes the most money. So you might have a corner in the Bronx, but you need to take over another block. The only way to take over another block is with violence. So what would happen is sex, money, murder had a reputation for killing anyone who stood in their way. And soon their reputation became so well known that they didn't have to murder anyone. People would just sort of step back and say, well, we don't want any part of that.
There are two New York City detectives who are police officers who became a big part of this story. Tell us about them.
John O'Malley actually grew up in Soundview, and then he joined Bronx Homicide right at the height of the crack epidemic. And they would have so many murders that it would be impossible to be able to solve every one, because at that time the violence was so intense that there was no way to get people in the neighborhoods to actually speak out about it, because they would put their lives in risk.
And then there was also a housing cop who was involved in your book.
Yeah, Pete Forselli. He worked as a housing cop, so he got to know all the guys in the neighborhood, and he knew all the leaders of the gang.
I think people who live outside New York may not know what a housing cop is. This is a cop who is assigned to duty in a public housing project or a series of projects.
Exactly. So you've got thousands of people living there who can't say anything about the gang because of the risk of retaliation.
So how did the police go about cracking this gang?
It's really difficult. And in the early 1990s, they really struggled, because what would happen is, because they would arrest guys, it was very hard to make a case because there would be no witnesses, no one's actually willing to say anything. And the guys who were caught got pretty low sentences, and they would go into jail and they would immediately join a gang inside and then come out again and still be part of the gang. So this whole process, this revolving door of state prisons, actually grows gangs.
I want to know a little bit more about how the cops cracked this gang, how they took them down, how they started to deal with this problem.
Well, it was around sort of 1995, and they realized that the murder rate in New York was so high, but everyone was focused on the mafia. No one was actually focusing on these street crews. So the feds and a pioneering prosecutor called Liz Glazer decided to apply RICO laws, which are racketeering laws, which are only used against the mafia. So what happens then is all the guys in the gang get charged with racketeering.
So RICO was a law originally set up to guys, you said, to go after the mafia. And it's not, you don't necessarily have to catch them committing the crime as long as you catch them organizing themselves in order to commit the conspiracy.
So anyone in the crew at that time, doesn't really matter if you've, you know, actually murdered a guy yourself, but if you're part of the crew and you're involved in murders, then you can be caught up in this whole thing. Now, when you go in the feds, it's very different to state time, because you face like 40 years or so. There's no parole, and you also get sent to prison out of state. You know, you can end up in Arizona. In New York, people would go into Rikers at first and then prisons upstate. And many of these guys got really used to this. You know,
and then when they go to prison, there would be people there they knew and make connections.
They knew everyone in there, so they'd be in there for like 4 years and then out again. Well, that doesn't happen in the feds. But the other thing in the feds, which is crucial to understanding this, is it works on cooperation. So there are certain guys in the crew who will be approached and said, look, you know, we're going to offer you the chance of telling us everything about what the crew has done, what you've done. So none of these guys can only give part of the loaf. They have to tell their whole criminal history.
To federal investigators.
Yes. Pretty soon, guys start to talk. So then you've shattered this conspiracy of silence, which was happening in the projects, where everyone was too scared to talk.
It's How Do We Fix It? I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Meggs.
And we're speaking with Jonathan Green, author of the brand new book, Sex, Money, Murder, A Story of Crack, Blood, and Betrayal.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Big pause. Why does your story need to be told?
Well, this is a problem which may have happened in the Bronx in the 1990s, but it's going on all over America right now. Like, you only have to look at Chicago, Baltimore, Detroit.
In the past few years, the murder rate in Chicago has gone up a lot. Why Chicago? What's going on?
I mean, it's the same thing. It's sort of inner city, not many opportunities. Young guys are, you know, looking for brothers and people to be on their side, and they're looking for ways of making money, and drugs is that. But the other thing is the sort of brotherhood of a gang. So it's very enticing.
And the status that comes with that.
And yeah, absolutely.
So we see killings increasing in Chicago and a rampant gang problem. As someone who's lived in and around New York throughout this whole period, it's so much better now. I mean, you can walk around in neighborhoods in the South Bronx that you wouldn't have set foot in the 90s. And they're nice. They're pretty nice.
Absolutely.
So what did New York get right?
Well, there's a number of things. I think Bill Brassen, who was the police commissioner at the time, I mean, he flooded the streets with police. I think people got less interested in smoking crack. There was like a natural decline in the appeal of the drug. You know, it became very unfashionable for young kids to be seen as a crackhead.
Right, so, there was a cultural change, wasn't
yeah,
there? Where the crackheads were really, really looked down on.
Yeah. I mean, also, a lot of the work of the feds sort of really helped. I mean, they took out some really violent gangs and they started to weed out these ringleaders.
So law enforcement can work. It's not always a revolving door into prison and right back to the streets.
No, it's very tough. I mean, I think in jail, I mean, I think you really have to start solving the problem in the street first, because these young guys go into jail and you know, they're really, for many of them, the only way to survive is to join a gang. So it swells the gang membership, and then they come to back on the street and they're fully invested now in the Bloods. So I really don't know how you solve the problem in the jails. I mean, it's very hard, because even to when they go into jail now, because they ask about their gang affiliation, and that's where you're housed. So you're with all the other guys in the gang. So the system as it is now feeds it.
Tell us a little bit about what happened with these guys. There's a very poignant section in your book where you catch up with Shug and Pipe, you know, after these years of crime and prison and everything else. How did these guys turn out? Where are they now?
Well, it's amazing. So both guys ended up cooperating in the feds. So they actually work within investigators and they help solve murders, but they had to sort of give everything up. Now, if you do that, the prosecutor in the case will write what's known as a 5K letter, which is a downward departure from the mandatory minimums in the feds.
You mean like it allows the judge not to impose the mandatory minimum sentence,
yes,
which is usually enormous.
A very long time. So in their case, they both got time served. So Pipe, who was actually a leader of the gang, he was OG, served, I think.
What's OG?
Original gangster.
Okay.
Yeah. So
sorry.
Don't listen much hip hop, do you?
No, sorry. As soon as you answered that, I went, oh, yeah, come on.
Okay. So like they both served, you know, relatively short sentences, and Pipe came out determined not to get involved again. He saw the sort of folly of his ways, and he was doing fantastically well. You know, and it's very tough as a felon to get employed, because you had this on your record. So, and it's very hard, particularly for a guy like that, because he's used to being in the nightclub with, you know, lots of money and gold chains and buying champagne and everything else. So he comes out, he has to work menial jobs. So it's a completely different mindset to someone who's had all this power. I mean, really a life and death power over other people.
Isn't he targeted also by other members of that gang?
Well, like that's
members?
The problem. Yeah, that is, you know, like when you snitch, that is one of the products of that. So both the guys have to be very so careful. You know, they can't go back to their neighborhood. But that's another positive of the federal system, that in the state they come out of jail, go straight back in the neighborhood, and it starts all over again. If you cooperate in the feds, which many people do, you have to move.
So Pipe went on and was trained to become an iron worker, right?
Yes, yeah. Like he went to night school and, you know, he works in the day and he studied at night and, you know, he saved up to buy a house. He sent his daughter to a private school. I mean, he was really thriving. Pilots had a few issues of late, which hopefully will resolve themselves. But by and large, I mean, he was doing really well. And many of the guys in Sex, Money, Murder who cooperated and grabbed this chance of a new life and left, and many of them have done really well. You know, they've never been rearrested, and they're very bright guys.
Right, right. Some of these guys are real. In a different world, they'd be entrepreneurs or
leaders.
Oh,
God, like they'd be millionaires. I mean, if they were born anywhere else, I mean, they're so clever, they're so good with money, they understand business, and like they would thrive. So many of them came out, and they do work small businesses and other things, never been rearrested because the federal system is so scary that it's a cold shock, you know.
Your book is mostly about the gang members, about the cops who went after them. Can community leaders, families, even churches make a difference in this struggle against gangs?
Yes, there's an absolutely terrific program that started in Boston called Operation Ceasefire. And the organizer of this realized that everyone in the community knows who the leaders of the gangs are. I mean, everybody knows. So what they do, they organize a big meeting with the police and members of the community and the gang leaders. And they say, look, we're all here. We know what's happening. We know who you are, what you're doing, and we're offering you a chance to stop. But if you don't, then we're going to come down really hard on you. But we're, you know, in a friendly environment here now, like we know it's you. And it's worked. I mean, it's had, it's really had some success. But I seriously doubt whether it would work against a crew like Sex, Money, Murder in Soundview. They were far too big, far too powerful. And
so much money was moving through.
So much money. I mean, they really became an organized crime syndicate. I mean, they started out as kids on a street corner, but because of the crack epidemic, they were able to grow in power completely unchecked for years and years. I mean, now most of the crews, I think, now are like arrested in 2 years.
So the policing has gotten that much better.
Yeah, it's so much better. I mean, particularly with social media, the police now are monitoring this all the time.
So data, better data. I mean, this actually goes, you mentioned Bratton, the New York was a pioneer in using more data to anticipate where crime was most likely. And you said they flooded the streets. Some of those programs were controversial, but from your account, it really worked pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, the big sort of game changer in the 90s was CompStat. And it was sort of started with a specific sort of mandate to track where all the murders were in the city. And that's how they were able to target neighborhoods like Soundview.
Deviancy amplification. What is that?
Well, it's a great phrase, isn't it? I first heard it when I was talking to a criminologist, and it's basically how when you have this revolving door of the state system, when young guys in gangs go inside and they serve, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years on a minor charge, they'll go into jail, and they may at that point just be part of a kind of corner crew, something not that serious. But you go inside and it's either like the Bloods or the Latin Kings. So they have to join a particular side to survive in jail, which then has a massive impact because when these guys are released, they're like full-blown Bloods with like ranking and hierarchy, and they're more powerful than they ever were when they went in.
So today, you know, in the 90s it was crack. Today we have this widespread issue with heroin and opiates in general, spread much more broadly and even in rural America. But are there some lessons from how the crack trade receded?
Yeah, I mean, I think it have to be in the same way that crack really sort of signed its own death warrant when it became culturally unacceptable for young people to smoke crack. If we could win the war against heroin, I think a huge part of it would be to make it, you know, socially unacceptable for people to start with oxycodone and these other drugs and to then get into heroin, but on the organized crime front, I mean, if there are specific crews moving large amounts of heroin and they're violent, then I think federal intervention is, you know, is really a sledgehammer to take down these networks, because they will crack once you arrest them all. RICO laws, I mean, they'll talk, you know, and then you bring the whole thing down.
Jonathan Green, author of Sex, Money, Murder, A Story of Crack, Blood, and Betrayal. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
So, Jonathan Green, Sex, Money, Murder, a title I could say over and over again. Jim, what's surprising to you about what he said?
Well, so much of what he's saying kind of goes against the grain of conventional wisdom today. You know, we hear again and again that law enforcement doesn't work, that, you know, people just go to prison and come back out and it's a revolving door. But here's a story where law enforcement actually did work to some extent, and even had a positive impact on some of the criminals, some, not all, who got caught up in the legal system and, you know, put on a better path.
It certainly goes against the grain to think that things could be getting better. And in this city where we live in New York, things in terms of violent crime are a lot better.
And I think you always hear this from me on How Do We Fix It. People respond to incentives, and there were a number of incentives that helped end the crack epidemic. I love the way Jonathan talked about how the culture changed and crackheads became figures of great disgust and disdain. That had an impact. I also think, when did the crack epidemic really start to wane? It was in the late 90s when the economy in the New York area was booming.
What about the role of pop culture? Where gangsters are constantly celebrated. I find that a little troubling.
Yes, I do too. But you remember all the songs and movies. I mean, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And, you know, there's been a lot of celebration of gangsters of various sorts. There was this famous anthropologist named Clifford Geertz. And he wrote an essay, one of the most influential essays in anthropology, called Notes on a Balinese Cockfight. He was observing these cockfights that were happening in native communities in Bali, and he described it as what he called a model of and a model for culture. In other words, the cockfight kind of recapitulated various status relationships within the society, but also became a model for the society. When people wanted to say, well, here's how things are organized, they would explicitly reference the cockfight, just the way people in business might explicitly reference, well, like, we're on the 10th yard line. You'd use football as a metaphor to explain what they're doing. So this makes me think that you can't underestimate the importance of culture when these figures are being celebrated in hip-hop, when hip-hop or other forms of entertainment are sort of setting the boundaries of what constitutes status. They're defining status.
The other thing that Jonathan Green's book does is it tells a fascinating story about people who, if they had not been raised
yes.
in housing projects in the Bronx, could have been extremely successful.
Yeah,
in
these
business.
Guys are
they're really smart,
charismatic, organized. It's in that way kind of a heartbreaking story. People in these really dire situations seizing this culture and you know, causing a lot of death and mayhem, but also when you read the book, it's also really understandable and you empathize with them.
It's How Do We Fix It. I'm Richard Davies.
And I'm Jim Mays.
And our producer is Miranda Schaefer. We are a production of Davies Content. Check us out at our website, daviescontent.com. And if you like listening to this podcast, you may want to take a listen to One Day University, which is a new podcast series that we've launched with the education firm One Day University. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.